Judy Cates. Justice Judy Cates is joining a Supreme Court nominee for the Democratic Party. You'll see her on the ballot 8 days from today. Judy, first off, morning, ma'am. How are you?
I'm great. How are you, Tom?
Good, good. I got a ton of questions. You mind if we just get started?
You always have tough questions.
Yeah, I do. The defining moment for you, with the time that you've had on the bench, right? Even maybe it wasn't even public, but something that happened that you considered maybe a challenge or it was a difficult decision. What has been your defining moment on the bench?
Oh, wow. I guess making the very first decision that I had to make. The very, very first case I ever came upon was a case involving a young man who had been in prison. And the question was he rightfully there or not? And what was the sufficiency of the evidence? And, of course, as I've been saying lately, you have to own what you write. So I think that was the defining moment where you have to decide whether you're going to let someone actually be free or not free.
We talk about impartiality, and it's been talked a lot about in this race in particular, but you notice this too. Wildly different decisions from people reading the same law books, and it's often drawn by party, but the law isn't written by party.
No, it's not, and that's one of the problems we have is people come into this race saying, well, I'm leaning this way, or I'm going to be a conservative. That's not the way the law is written. The law is written for all people. And so being transparent and owning what you write is the most important thing you can do. And you need to have the integrity to stand up against whatever influences there are out there and say, I'm going to do what's right.
Why so long to your court decisions? You and I spoke about this a while back. We come back in and the decision, Supreme Court will rule, crucial decisions that are delayed for years in some cases. And while the problem worsens, I think the best example was the pension law, the legislation there, and the Supreme Court says you couldn't do it. Well, I told you this last time you and I spoke. Anybody can read the Constitution knows that was not feasible by constitutional standards. So why so long to hear decisions that are seemingly cut and dried?
Well, as I told you last time, I think our time period for rendering decisions has gotten much better, at least in the Fifth District Appellate Court where your listeners are. But more importantly, it comes down to politics, doesn't it? When you let politics seep into the courtroom, then people want to write a decision a certain way, and then everybody's talking behind the scenes about how the decision should be written, how it should come out. You have these political influences going on. And so it's kind of a round robin behind the scenes as far as how that order is going to get written.
You know, there's been a lot of battle in this campaign, right? Now, the level of commitment you have, and I think this is what you were trying to illustrate, was your level of commitment to the Second Amendment when you recently challenged your opponent to a gun range shootout.
Well, we were having a turkey shoot event, and, you know, my opponent has appeared one time in a staged, on a staged gun range, where you don't need a FOID card to necessarily hold a gun. That's something different, very different than if you walked into a store and you tried to buy a gun. You'd have to show your FOID card. So we were having a little turkey shoot event, and I was going to be shooting my shotgun anyway. So I suggested to a reporter that maybe my opponent come out and join me. And it kind of evolved into a news media challenge, but it really wasn't that way. I was going to be out shooting my shotgun, and he keeps saying he has a FOID card, but he won't show it to anybody. So I thought, well, come on out. He didn't.
Right. All right. So that it's been misrepresented in some. Well, because I'm telling you, compared to the story you just told me in the published articles I read yesterday, two different stories.
Well, isn't it always?
Right. You know, but when it comes to guns, it's interesting because you and I spoke a lot about this in gun owners' rights. But here's the thing. When I try to stand back and look at Illinois, I don't see so much about gun owners right now as I do legislation that undermines the Second Amendment in another way. Oppressive gun store legislation, limiting access hours, making it cost prohibitive to keep the doors open. You know, when it comes to gun rights, I think this legislation I'm seeing, or it's in effect, it's really had a devastating effect. Well, we've already seen it, the small numbers of stores re-upping their licenses, Illinois getting in the licensing gun store game.
Well, and I think I told you the very first time we spoke, which kind of shocked you, that I was against this fingerprinting for obtaining a gun. But unfortunately, you're right. Our little businesses have been having trouble, although I will say that gun sales are up. People are very concerned, which, again, I don't think they need to be, especially if I'm your Supreme Court justice. They don't need to be. But, yes, you're absolutely right. And what's really more oppressive to people who want to buy a gun is it's taking the state police 60, 90, 120 days to get these new FOID cards either renewed or issued. And the law is clearly not that. I think they have 60 days to do it, and they're way, way behind. Or maybe less, maybe 30. I'm not sure of the exact number. But regardless, the state police are way behind, and there's litigation already on this.
Yeah.
We need to do better for our small businesses.
I believe the number is 161 and a half days to get a return on a gun owner's FOID card in the state of Illinois when the law says 30 days.
30 days, right.
Right, but I think the only state police website says 161.5 days is the average wait. You know what's interesting about this? Very often when we have the conversation with guns and somebody in political office, they keep, well, people, hunters don't have to worry. It's hunting is not why the Second Amendment's there. It's just not.
No, it's not.
it's home protection. It's government tyranny. Why do people choose to always make the common denominator hunting when, in fact, gun ownership on a legal basis is really not about hunting?
Well, I think mostly it's about, and I wouldn't want to speculate as in, you know, what's in people's minds. But I know at least in southern Illinois, especially now with bow hunting season going on, you know, people want to have the right to go out and eat, feed their families. You know, many times this is what people do. And so it transitions into a gun thing. But you're right. The Second Amendment was first established so that we could all protect our homes and that there would be a militia always ready against tyranny.
Judy, we had a press release that was out last week, and it was, I read it. It was very busy. So, one, this press release calling on your opponent to explain a decision involving a sex offender. What can you tell me about your press release last week? And the reason why I'm asking, Judy, is tomorrow David Overstreet will be on the program. I'm going to ask him the same question. Explain to me the issue of the sex offender that has garnered so much attention in this campaign.
Well, this is where experience as a prosecutor comes in. So I was a prosecutor for 4 years, as you know, and I did many of these cases. And what happened in this particular case is the sex offender had been molesting this six-year-old child for many years, and I mean oral sex, the most cruel and desperate kind of sex that could go on between a man and a six-year-old child. Unimaginable, although the details are in the opinion quite explicitly. But the day before trial, this man came to the court, and the judge said, look, do you know where you need to be tomorrow? And the defendant said, yeah, I need to be in court. It's my trial date. And so the next morning, everybody showed up except the defendant. He had voluntarily ingested Tylenol and went to the hospital about 3 in the morning. So, i.e., he could not be in court. We have a rule in Illinois called being tried in absentia, which means if you don't show up for your court date and you've been given due notice of when you got to be there and why you have to be there, the court can go ahead with the trial. And that's what happened in this case. The court went ahead with the trial, and the man was convicted and got 35 years in prison for molesting this child. He spent 3 years, and again, this shows you how long appeals take, 3 years in prison, and my opponent, Dave Overstreet, and two other judges voted to release this man, vacate his conviction, just because he wasn't there. And that's not what the law says. The law says he can be tried. He was there the day before, and he didn't show up. The victim showed. His attorney showed. His family showed. Everybody showed except he did. And had I been on the panel, I would never have vacated his conviction. And it goes back to owning what you write. You've got to own what you write. And I know now that that little girl's in hiding. She can't come out again. And so what happens? There's no victim to testify. So it remains to be seen what will happen with this case. But that case, in my view, was a tragedy for this victim.
Right.
And now, of course, they're making him the victim when he's the perpetrator of the offense.
All right, a couple of items from the items that I could glean from this. One, that the man in question by the last name of Peoples, correct?
Correct.
Was in a coma in more than one published report that I read.
Well, I don't know about a coma, but it was self-induced, you see.
Right.
He voluntarily took the medication. Anybody, if you take enough aspirin or Tylenol, you're going to get in a coma.
Right.
But he voluntarily took it. This wasn't something that was a mistake. He intended to avoid his trial, and that's what the law says. If you willfully intend to be absent from your trial, then we're going to try you in absentia. And he was warned about that. And it's even in the opinion. If you go to the opinion and read it, it says the judge asked him, are you going to be here tomorrow morning? Yes, sir, I know where to be here. Boom, he doesn't show up.
Now,
there's something wrong with that.
And the other item that from this, and then we can move on to some other stuff here, was that, you mentioned this was a three-judge panel. Overstreet did not write the decision. I believe it was Judge Wharton then did, and the other judges then agreed with this. And, of course, you said you wouldn't have agreed. Would that, if you were on that court and disagreed, would it change the outcome?
I don't know, because, again, here you have people behind the scenes, fight vigilantly for a position. Yes, it could have absolutely changed the opinion. I have cases with Judge Wharton already where, and he and I have a long history together, where he and I have talked about cases already since he's been on the bench in only the last 10 months. And we've changed our minds. That's what we do when we talk behind the scenes. And that's, by the way, what dissents are for. Because had Justice Overstreet felt strongly about it, he could have written a dissent. He's written dissents on several of my cases, and yet he didn't write a dissent on this one, nor did he fight for it.
Okay.
So he's got to own what he writes. It doesn't matter who wrote the opinion. He concurred. And so he believes in what he did, and that's, we have a very big difference of opinion. You don't let child molesters out when you've got a 6-year-old who testified at 8. Now she's probably 11 or 12. Do you really think she wants to go through that again?
Right. Justice Overstreet did order a new trial at the end of this, though, too, correct?
A new trial, but that's, again, where experience comes in. Do you really think she's going to go through this again at age 12? She's already been terrorized once.
Okay.
It was hard enough as a 6-year-old to go through and testify to what she did. She showed up that morning. Everybody showed up that morning except the defendant who voluntarily ingested heroin or anything like that. He voluntarily ingested what the press has misconstrued as some kind of evil drug. It wasn't. It was a Tylenol-based drug.
Okay.
And it was simply to avoid trial. That's it. I mean, read the opinion and you can draw your own conclusions.
All right. So we got another issue here, too, because a lot of this is accusations going back and forth. Part of it is that you misrepresent yourself as a Republican, and there was another one that you addressed, so if we can hit both of these, in the press release that you issued last week, where they say you're taking money from Speaker Madigan. We all know the context in which that is. And in that press release, you came out and said, I am not accepting one single dime from the Speaker, and I'm calling on him to step down. So are you receiving money from Mike Madigan?
No. In fact, I don't want any of Mike Madigan's money. I paid Mike Madigan's, it's not even his committee, I paid a committee, I think it was $5,000 to get access to a voter file. Very different, by the way, I got a letter from the State Board of Elections where the Illinois Republican Party has now dropped $1 million into David Overstreet's campaign as of Tuesday. $700,000 in a television buy and almost $200,000 in mail. So almost shy, little shy of $1 million into that race. That's taking money. I haven't done that. And I don't intend to take his money, and I won't be able to compete with $1 million. So if he buys the race, he buys the race. That's what they did in 2004, and that's what they're trying to do now.
Right. One of the most expensive Supreme Court history races between Carmire and Mag. That's the one you're talking about, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So you called on Speaker Madigan to step down.
Well, Speaker Madigan has been the leader of the party for a long time, and I have never been in party politics, contrary to what they want to play me. I think you know from our conversations that I'm pretty much straight down the line. So I'm not representing myself as a Republican. That's strictly Republican propaganda. And in the context of that, I said perhaps it's time for Speaker Madigan to step down. There's a lot of questions around his leadership. But as I said, I'm not a party politics player. I really believe in the integrity of the court. That's what we need to restore, not $1 million to buy the race.
Justice Overstreet's joining us this morning, Supreme Court candidate. You'll see her on the ballot 8 weeks from 8 days from today. Here's some questions as we conclude on some other issues. One comes
this
from
is
a listener.
Conclusion. I'm Kate.
I'm Judy Cates. Sorry, yeah. Get that right. Now let's see
all
here.
Right.
One is comes. I'm sorry. I'm listening. I'm reading stuff from my American Monument text line. I think this is a great question. Do you support the Bail Reform Act?
You mean no cash bail?
Yeah.
No, I don't support that.
Yeah, I always thought that was interesting, and I wish I had thought of the question. You know, if you look at what you and I, Judy Cates, I'm going to get that right, joining me this morning, Supreme Court Justice candidate, Democratic Party, a lot of what we're talking about here is a commitment to independence, to reading the law book, to taking a look at precedents. Why you, in the context of this commitment to independence, why Judy Cates?
Because Judy Cates is going to fight for Southern Illinois and make the court more transparent. Right now, we have too much secrecy and distrust amongst the court. The Supreme Court justice who wins this race is going to pick future judges. Justice Carmire, who is retiring, picked 45 judges. There is no diversity. Only 6 women have been selected. We need a change for Southern Illinois. We need people who are more experienced and who reflect Southern Illinois values. I don't think we have judges on this court right now who do that. So the next Supreme Court justice is going to make sure, if it's me, that we have a judiciary that can be trusted and that you have a level playing field when you walk into the courtroom.
Judy Cates. Judy, is there anything else that you and I need to talk about, things that I should have asked you in your opinion that you'd like to address now? Because, you know, we're talking 8 days. Tomorrow at this same time, Justice David Overstreet will be asking the same questions that we're talking about. Of course, some of them from the other side of the aisle, looking back and forth because these have been so much when it comes to the ads and messaging. But let's strip all that away. What do you have to say about this upcoming race? You know, is there a question I should have asked you today that I didn't?
Well, I think you should have asked me how I feel about all these attack ads, because we certainly haven't gone to the length of these attack ads at all. You know, the Republican Party, as I said, is putting $1 million into attack ads to call me things that I'm not. That's a la 2004 Supreme Court race. What we did is we reported one case that involves Judge Overstreet and a sexual molestation victim. That's the honest-to-God truth, and that's what integrity is about. Instead, the Republican Party has decided that they're going to label me, they're going to distort pictures of me, run ads with distorted pictures that have been Photoshopped. You know, I know I don't look good already but at my age, but the Photoshopping has really done me bad. But that said, I think that you can't buy the race. I hope that the people of Southern Illinois will understand that this is not something that should be tolerated in a Supreme Court race. Integrity means that you do the right thing all the time, every time, not just one time. So I appreciate the opportunity, Tom.
Judge.
And one last thing, the
sure.
Bail Reform Act, I think, hurts counties, small counties especially, because that cash bail is used for funding committees and like the violence protection funds, that if we didn't have the bail, there would be no money from the criminal defendants to support these mandates from the Supreme Court. So I think that that Cash Bail Act really works against small counties, and we have to protect our small counties.
Yeah, the state's attorneys have said they never seem to mention the money as more often as the reoffense, that they go back out when we release them and they go back out again. And this has been an issue in between Jackson and Williamson County, I think, on
Absolutely.
Another level as well.